A rapid succession of animal eyes. BBC Natural World. A 4x4 traverses a stone-strewn landscape.
Search and rescue teams are crossing Iceland's central plateau. A few kilometres below them, a huge reservoir of molten magma shakes the ground as it makes its way to the surface.
A vast plain.
The question is not if an eruption will take place, but when and where. Icelanders have turned their unstable, cold, rugged island into one of the most modern and culturally rich nations on Earth. But they still keep one foot in the wild and a very careful eye on the beast stirring beneath them. Over what turns out to be an explosive year, and through the eyes of wild foxes, an eider duck farmer, and Viking horsemen, we'll see why everything on Iceland remains uniquely connected to the land underfoot.
Iceland, land of ice and fire. Narrated by Juliet Stevenson. The green, shimmering lights of Aurora Borealis.
Under the eerie glow of the northern lights, Iceland is in the iron grip of winter.
A time lapse shows the green lights, tinged with red, dominating the night skies.
Lying close to the Arctic Circle, with just a few hours of light a day, it has endured months below zero.
Beams of light radiate out from a dazzling white sun, turning it into a flower-like jewel hanging in a periwinkle blue sky above an icy wilderness. Winds carry snow across the landscape.
At this time of year, it's hard to imagine Iceland's fiery origins, but the island emerged as molten lava from deep beneath the Atlantic Ocean. It's one of the planet's newest pieces of land. Everywhere are reminders of how little time it's had to shed its raw, rocky character, and how closely it's connected to the very centre of the Earth.
Clouds of steam rise up from gaps in the rock. A snow-clad peak stands in silent majesty.
Iceland is so new and so isolated in the North Atlantic that until relatively recently, there were no land mammals here at all.
White waves and spray crash against large lumps of ice, blue in colour, some of which lie stranded on black, stony coastlines.
But during the last ice age, when it was connected to Greenland by ice bridges and ice floes, a very tenacious predator turned up.
A white-furred fox narrows its eyes against icy winds.
The Arctic fox.
Another fox is black.
Iceland's first land mammal, in its many colour variations, was here to stay.
The white fox starts a slow prowl down a slope.
But how it survived on Iceland, without any of its regular prey, like lemmings, has long fascinated scientist Esther Unsteinsdottir.
This is an Arctic species. It's adapted to the Arctic winter, which is really cold, and you can see it on the thick fur. It's the thickest fur in the universe. It's very well insulating.
It's actually better than a polar bear's against the biting cold.
The white fox stops and sniffs the air for a moment.
Enduring extreme weather is one thing. Its biggest challenge on Iceland is finding food.
They need to eat. And if they don't have food, enough food in the winter time, especially before breeding, they don't manage to breed properly.
There is a remarkable lifeline. An arm of the Gulf Stream helps to keep much of Iceland's long, rocky coastline ice-free. So even in winter, foxes can scavenge the washed-up remains of fish, seabirds, and sea mammals.
The white fox stands on large grey boulders which are lashed with spray from the sea. Esther's using binoculars to look across a dour wintry landscape.
Only the toughest foxes hold on to a slice of good shoreline territory and get the chance to breed. But first, they have to find a mate.
A dark-furred fox circles near another, keening. From a distance, the white fox watches the pair, one of whom presents to the other. Then they mate.
A dark male appears to have won over a brown female. A white male is desperate to mate with her too.
The white fox scampers over to the brown female
and succeeds in grabbing her attention.
Esther's watching the chase.
For a while, he seems to have outfoxed his rival.
The dark and white fox engage in a struggle for supremacy down at the water's edge as the female runs on.
But it doesn't end well for him. The white male will have to try elsewhere. Hopefully, this brown female, with the victor in tow, has the strength she'll need to have a family.
Esther finds the body of a white fox.
For the weak or the inexperienced, winter is a punishing time. Less than half of all foxes survive.
Brooding grey-blue seas border the rocky shore, the reflection of a seal's head in water. Now, large seals lying in groups on ice floats.
Sea mammals have an easier ride. The ice-free waters offer some of the best fishing in the North Atlantic, attracting not just seals, but whales and dolphins. These fertile seas were a good reason for humans to settle here too. The first Vikings colonized Iceland just over 1,000 years ago. Down the generations, through fishing and farming, they have carved out a unique way of dealing with the many limits to life. Most of Iceland's people, just over 300,000 of them, are descended from the original settlers, and many still work the land in tried and tested ways. Even their livestock traces back to the animals the Vikings brought with them.
The silhouette of a dark horse through the soft blur of falling snow.
Purest and most admired is the Icelandic horse. It's smaller and much hardier than most other breeds. Owners give them a little help towards winter's end, but mostly they tough out the cruelest of weather. The best way to raise livestock here is to keep the animals semi-wild. It gives them the character and spirit to survive in this austere volcanic landscape.
A tan and white Icelandic horse stands alone in the unforgiving landscape.
But with little prime grazing land, Icelanders could never rely on their livestock alone. Long ago, the arrival of squadrons of swans, ducks, and geese would have offered relief from dwindling winter rations.
Four swans in flight.
One species offered much more than a meal. Eider ducks are among the millions of birds that are drawn to Iceland from all around the North Atlantic.
The eider ducks ride the stormy seas.
These days, Thor Bjornsson makes an unusual living from them. But he can't start work until the eiders have finished pairing up and have come ashore.
A black and white eider duck throws its head back. Some of the ducks have brown plumage. Now a silhouette of Thor with an orange sun in the far distance.
He and the birds are waiting for spring.
The sun bestows a burnt orange sheen to the sea. A black and white eider duck rises from the water and flaps its wings.
Exposed all winter to brutal Atlantic storms, Iceland has been blanketed by huge volumes of snow.
Droplets of water hang, then fall from icicles. Now, water gushing over rocks.
When that melts, it fills thousands of streams and rivers.
Clouds of water spray.
And cascades over some of Europe's largest and most powerful waterfalls.
Flanked either side by an austere ridge of grey rock, a waterfall is nestled in the middle, bringing colour to the landscape with water that's white with spray as it cascades gently downwards. Another waterfall offers a sheer drop, sending up clouds of water droplets. An enormous waterfall is the picturesque backdrop to two horses grazing on a slope.
Iceland is so new and remote that relatively few species have made it here.
Local flora in the sunshine.
Its hardy pioneers are always under pressure. Even now, it's a race to make the most of longer, warmer days ahead.
A large white bird settles in the outer branches of a tree.
After a winter of famine, male ptarmigan are hungry to reach the buds packed with proteins, which are swelling at the top of willows and birches.
Moving to another branch.
It's a precarious high wire act for a bird that spends the majority of its time on the ground.
Blue skies above, and Thor's standing on top of a grassy ridge, looking out over water.
Down on the coast, Thor is impatient for the eiders to get on with mating.
An eider mounts its mate in the water. Now, an eider in long grass on land.
Millions of other migrating and resident birds are already nursing eggs, set to take advantage of what will be a very short but bountiful summer.
An eider, with brown plumage and a snowy breast, settles down in long grass, while a male eider with black and white feathers lands next to two speckled eggs, moss green in colour.
Eventually, the eiders return to the western islands of Breiðafjörður, finding the same nest scrapes that their mothers and grandmothers used before them.
A female turns an egg.
The mother duck cradles her eggs in a pillow of down collected from her own breast feathers. There is no other duck down like it. It's this down that Thor wants to harvest, but he'll need his extended family to help gather it.
A group of people.
Thor's farm consists of nearly 300 small islands, and they'll have to deal with over 3,000 wild eider ducks.
Large dinghies with outboard motors.
It's going to be a busy few weeks.
Hilly terrain under a cloudy sky.
Spring has finally reached Hornstrandir, the craggy, lonely, northwestern corner of Iceland.
A young fox cub in long grass and a small white bird perched on a rock.
After a severe winter, this female fox is hanging around one of only two den sites. The lack of food over the past few months will have taken its toll, but now she has to step up a gear. She's looking after not just herself.
Another small cub with soft grey fur wanders out of a den. Two more cubs bundle down a slope towards their mother.
But six newborn cubs.
They greet her eagerly.
Her work is cut out. She's a mum with a sky-high milk bill. Just to keep up production, she's going to have to spend the next weeks hunting full-time.
She comes to a halt in lush green foliage, and the cubs cluster around her. Then she stands patiently as they all latch onto her teats to feed.
Arctic foxes are feisty opportunists. They may be small, but when livestock arrived on Iceland, they soon worked out how to kill animals much larger than themselves. In response, the early settlers began hunting foxes to keep their numbers under control. Today, foxes still take livestock, and the hunting quotas enshrined in law in the 13th century are still in force. On Iceland's marginal land, the challenges facing both fox and farmer cannot be underestimated. Making a living out here is tough. For farmers like Haldor, horses are their pride and joy. These days, Haldor and his son-in-law Snorri mostly breed them for riding.
A white horse with a tan mane drooping down, fringe-like into its eyes.
Horses are still better than 4x4s on Iceland's rough tracks and mountain passes, just as sturdy and dependable as when they were the backbone of Icelandic communities.
Since long ago, the horse has been the animal closest to man in Iceland. A dog's lying on the floor of the workshop where a horse has been led inside to be reshoed. Haldor continues, the ancients seem to prefer to travel by horse, or at least it was their vehicle of choice. He's using a slightly curved metal tool called a hoof pick to trim layers of dirt from the horse's hoof. The horse was used everywhere as a working animal, he says. It would even carry our coffin from home to the graveyard when life drew to an end. Snorri's holding the reins of the horse, which has now been reshoed.
The finest horses became highly regarded status symbols.
And it was considered a great thing to own a thoroughbred horse. A good horse that took you out into nature and to other farms. You become known as the best of horsemen. Having saddled two horses, Haldor and Snorri ride off down a dirt path.
You had a lot of respect if you had the best horse. Even if you were a poor farmer, if you had the best horse, you had respect. Really important for the young guys to have a nice horse when they were looking for girls. And you came with good clothes on a nice horse, you had a good chance.
Now, a soft orange sky beset with clouds. Two horses graze.
Every spring, Haldor checks on his pregnant mares. He hopes his favourite stallion will be the father. The very best foals will be much admired at the end-of-year roundup, but Haldor has no control over their arrival. They give birth to their foals in secret, often after dark and without help.
A horse silhouetted in the sun.
Haldor has to trust that his mares are robust enough to cope.
A large rainbow stretches from sea to sky. A lone house surrounded by grass. Now a female eider settles down on some eggs.
Over 3,000 eider ducks are now settled on eggs on Thor's islands.
People wander about on a grassy slope near a stretch of calm water.
He and his family carefully comb each rocky outcrop, looking for nests. Thor's unusual livelihood allows him to spend time in the wildest parts of Iceland, among the nature he loves so much.
I started about 1970, and then I was 14 years old, and I found it very, very nice to be with a bird like this, collecting down and all the wildlife around it.
Thor carefully sets the eggs aside, removes the down, and will re-cushion the eggs in soft, warm hay. The female ducks can then return to their duties with no harm done. His yield is limited by the number of birds that return each year.
Some years are better than others, and we get up to 55 kilos of eider down. Normally it's about 65 nests in 1 kilo of down.
Eiders have proved tricky to domesticate. Their down can only be farmed from wild birds. To increase overall numbers, Thor collects and rears a few offspring that may not otherwise survive.
A lot of young ones, eider ducklings, die in many ways. Bad weather, wet and windy, they cannot get enough food. So normally they maybe raise up one duckling, two ducklings, something like that. We take one or two eggs from the nest, depends how many eggs are in the nest. When we started here, it was about something between 500 or 600 eiders nesting in the homeland area, but now it's more than 1,000, so they come back.
While his eggs are incubating, Thor gets down to business. Nearly three-quarters of all eider duck down comes from Iceland, and it's all gathered by hand. Thor's family painstakingly pick the down clean before it's bagged up for sale. Most becomes a cozy filling for high-end duvets, quilts and jackets.
Holding a piece of down between finger and thumb.
Its secret may lie in the way the fibres flex and lock together, creating thousands of minuscule air pockets. It's such effective insulation that it's been used to keep astronauts warm in space. This is duck down that's flown to the moon and back.
A duckling hatches under the coziness of Thor's heat lamp eiderdown nest.
After a few days under a heat lamp, Thor's ducklings begin to hatch. They grow quickly. In the wild, eider ducklings can fledge after just a month.
A cluster of ducklings. Now Thor opens a green wooden door on a shed.
But under Thor's wing, they stand a much better chance of making it to adulthood.
The ducklings, now much larger, waddle down a wooden ramp out of the shed. They're kept enclosed in a shallow pen with low wooden walls. He gets down on the grass to check on them.
For these first days, at least, they only have eyes for their new duck dad. They won't follow him around long term, but Thor will have to spend the rest of the summer as a stay-at-home father, teaching them skills they'll need to become wild birds.
Indigo skies at sunset.
The longest days of the year are approaching, when the sun barely dips below the horizon. The fullness of summer is only really felt around the island's edges.
A time-lapse shows shadows moving on rock and water rising.
Hardly anything lives on the vast, ash-covered central plateau. Its many volcanoes erupt too frequently and violently to give life much chance. It's like a sleeping giant that everyone's turned their back on, but dares not forget is there.
Now the six cubs with their mother. One of them jumps playfully on her back and she bears it without complaint. Someone's walking through a flowery meadow.
Watching over the fox family, Esther is spending more and more time on the Hornstrandir Peninsula.
Walking down a slope.
The cubs have been weaned, but Mum's workload just gets bigger by the day. Sibling rivalry can be lethal. It's thought that each fight reinforces their rank in the family. Dogged determination decides who gets most food and who ultimately survives.
One cub clamps its jaws onto the fur at the rear of its sibling, pulling them backwards while a third sits nearby, observing. The mother's watching. She suddenly heads over and intercedes, and the cub walks away.
This mum seems to be made of particularly stern stuff and is providing for all six of the cubs.
Small pockets of snow are nestled on an upward slope at the end of the peninsula. The mother fox sits quietly.
She's raising her family close to one of the most prolific seabird colonies in Iceland. There's lots of tempting food on offer. The problem is that it's perched on sheer walls of rock.
She licks her chops, then jumps down from the rocky perch she's sitting on. On and around it, her cubs are wandering about. One goes to follow her, but eventually they all remain behind as she trots off to hunt.
If ever there was a high-stakes game, this mother is playing it.
Esther's sitting in the grass, using a pair of binoculars to look across to the cliffs, the fox's perilous destination.
One full step, and she will plunge hundreds of meters onto the rocks below. Her cubs will effectively die with her.
Having made her way down to a sloping shelf, the mother stops for a moment and looks across to where various seabirds are perched. Elsewhere, seagulls adorn another incline not far from the fox, but dangerous to get to. She turns around and trots back. Esther's still watching. As the mother picks her way through the grass that's on the upper reaches of the slope, she has something in her jaws.
She's found a kittiwake. But with a growing family, she will have to risk her life over and over again. Today, she has the cliffs to herself. But until the 1950s, foxes were in direct competition with the people who eked out a living on this far-flung peninsula.
It was very harsh, even for humans. You know, it was really tough, bad winters, and not easy to survive. So both for humans and foxes. And they were probably using the same resources, both space and food. So they were feeding on birds and eggs, and that's what people were also feeding on.
On the remote island of Grimsay, they still gather eggs from the massive summer colonies. Its long coastline and towering cliffs of resistant volcanic rock provide ledge space for thousands of kittiwakes and guillemots, and burrows above for puffins.
A puffin looks out over sun-kissed waters, holding food in its beak. Now, a tractor's parked at the top of a cliff.
Across Iceland, there is still the taste for seabird eggs, a traditional and free-range alternative to battery-farmed chicken eggs. These days, the kit may be relatively modern, but it still requires an old-fashioned head for heights.
Someone's lowered down the side of the cliff on a rope, wearing a camera on their helmet, which shows their dangerous work close up, using a stick with a net on it to gently scoop an egg from a ledge.
Timing is crucial. Eggs are scooped up right after laying, the theory being that as soon as the birds realise their egg has gone, they'll relay. The collectors simply delay the hatch by a few days.
On top of the cliff, a man's standing by the tractor, holding a length of rope in his hand. The egg collector's stick is very long, enabling them to reach across rocky shelves and deftly scoop up eggs. One proves a little trickier as the net is nearly full, and the egg is rolled upwards alongside the cliff until it gently plops into the net.
The length of cliff, which each collector sweeps, is strictly controlled.
The tractor drives forward, winching the collector back up.
Today, these eggs are sold through supermarkets or traded for autumn berries from the mainland.
Holding their long stick vertically in one hand, the egg collector effectively walks slowly up the side of the cliff as the tractor pulls them up towards the top. Waiting for them is a small group of people. Now the eggs, speckled and varying in hue from turquoise to white, are sorted.
For many, foraging remains a part of everyday life, tapping into the rich natural resources around them.
A cluster of eggs next to a grey plastic basket. Now, turbulent water.
The most remarkable resource of all is the heat beneath their feet.
Sulphur clouds and gravel erupt from an active geyser,
The island lies over the edge of two continental plates that are pulling away from each other. Iceland is being stretched apart in the middle. It's the easiest place for boiling molten rock to rise towards the surface. This readily heats groundwater, which day to day can be rather useful. Long ago, Icelanders discovered how it could slow cook one of their most celebrated foods, lava bread. Every household has its own secret recipe for roux-brow, but each loaf will be baked in much the same way.
A bucket of dough.
Once the dough is bucketed up, it will be placed in a hot spring. Nearly every rural community has one. And then left for 24 hours.
A woman carries a bucket of dough towards a hot spring from which clouds of steam are issuing into the air. Setting it down, she secures the lid with small rocks.
The immense geothermal power on offer has transformed the lives of all Icelanders. They live just south of the Arctic Circle, yet modern ground-heated greenhouses allow them to ripen vegetables and fruits that wouldn't otherwise stand a chance of growing here.
Cucumbers, peppers and tomatoes all grow within the greenhouses.
They've created a sustainable bubble in which plants and their pollinators defy the limits of growing on raw northern rock.
Two bees inside the greenhouse.
But along with their daily bread, Icelanders are fed updates on the many earthquakes that occur on the island. It's as routine as the weather forecast. And this year, it seems, more important than ever. In late May, a swarm of 200 earthquakes register under the Baldrabunkur volcano in central Iceland. It lies under Europe's largest glacier, Vatnajökull, and eruptions in the past have caused catastrophic floods.
Viewed from above, some of the terrain is blackened.
There's no evidence as yet that magma is on its way to the surface, but pilots overflying the area are asked to keep an eye on any changes to the ground below them.
A tractor's parked outside a neat red-roofed single-story house.
On this extraordinary island, ordinary life simply goes on. There have been over a dozen eruptions in Halldór's lifetime alone. Right now, he has more immediate concerns.
A small grey creature lies on the ground, obscured by green scrub.
One of his mares has just given birth. Like many creatures that evolved on open grassland, the foal's instinct is to get on its feet as quickly as possible.
The foal, grey in colour, contrasting with the tan and white of its mother, slowly struggles to stand upright on its thin, spindly legs which shake. Eventually it's upright, and it starts to take tentative steps across the rough scrub of the land, moving towards its mother. Halldór watches this from a distance using a set of binoculars.
It seems healthy.
He looks relieved. The grey foal circles around slowly, close to its mother, while another foal, mostly tan with a white star on its forehead, lies comfortably on the ground.
The new foals will stay close to their mothers for most of their first year. But it may be the last Halldór sees of them for a long while.
A foal playfully kicks back at another.
Soon, all his horses will move up the valley and into the mountains. It will give these lower pastures a break. But the move is also important to encourage the foals to run free. If they're to survive their first winter, they need to become resilient.
The horses standing in a loose group on pasture land.
Horses from all the farms around here are allowed to return to their roots. Just like the ancestral wild horse of the Eurasian steppes, they'll roam in large herds and won't see their owners for many months.
you want to keep this wildness a little bit in the horses, and this is the best place to do that. And it's also really important that young horses go there, foals, to learn this as quick as possible. This strongs their mind a lot to do this, because you never know in Iceland if it gets lost on the mountains, that they know how to help themselves. I think also for the growing of the horses and the young horses, it's like it grows much better and stronger on the mountains.
The Skagafjordur region prides itself on producing the very best Icelandic horses. Strict rules control the breed. A horse sold abroad is never allowed to return, having lost the magic mix of wildness and trainability. This is the trait Halldór's foals must develop if they are to do him proud at the end of year roundup.
Wild horses are scattered across a grassy valley, grazing peacefully. The sun peeps through stony grey clouds to cast scant shine on the sea. A simple dwelling on a headland.
The short summer is pressing on. Wild eider ducks are already leading their young broods out on the water.
A row of ducklings float along on the water's surface, then an adult dives.
The eider is a diving duck that spends the whole winter living at sea. It's vital they become powerful swimmers.
The ducklings also try diving beneath the surface.
Thor's ducklings too must begin learning how to face the trials ahead.
Thor's ducklings waddle out of the pen and through the grass.
Younger members of the family lead the way.
They get very quickly, very big and strong. And we'd bring them to the sea every day, or sometimes twice a day, to feed in the sea and swim a little bit.
Here, they'll build up their muscles and sharpen their instincts. They're still vulnerable to the cold and to ravenous black-backed gulls, so the children must guide and protect them.
First days, we have to look very well after them, because they want to go away. So we try to gather them and so they don't swim away.
This willful streak is good. It means they haven't been tamed.
Underwater, the ducklings happily dive to the bottom of the pond, which is waist high on the children, and swim around eagerly at speed. The children keep a close eye on the brood.
All in all, it's a fun way for the kids to connect with nature.
The eider ducklings continue to swim about, their wet plumage gleaming in the sunshine.
And the smallest member of the family gets to talk down to someone else.
A small boy stands on land and bends over to gaze at a lone duckling. Now back on shore, two ducklings shake themselves and attempt to preen their feathers after their seaside dip. Children and ducklings all eventually leave the water and start to clamber up the grassy slope.
It's home time. The ducklings are gently herded and counted back in, where they'll fluff themselves back up in readiness for the next stage of their training.
Back in their pen, the ducklings amble back up the ramp into the shed.
For now, it's job done.
A child lies on the grass and kisses the camera. Back at the peninsula.
In Hornstrandir, the Atlantic Ocean is slowly gnawing at what remains of a very ancient and immense lava flow.
A lone walker.
On its unforgiving edge, the mother fox has defied the odds.
She lopes along a path back to her cubs, two of whom are playfully snapping at each other.
All six of her cubs are still alive. Although life is a challenge, they currently stand a better chance in Iceland than elsewhere in the Arctic.
A cub grabs the kill.
There's very few Arctic foxes left in Scandinavia, and they have been endangered for many, many years. But they're facing troubles that we are not facing here in Iceland.
Esther believes the big problem for Arctic foxes in Scandinavia is the northward march of the red fox due to climate change. As it moves into Arctic fox territory, the red fox takes over their den sites, competes for food, and even kills adults and young. The Arctic foxes on Iceland remain out of reach. The island is an important stronghold for them. Mum's job is nearly done. In the next few weeks, the cubs will leave home.
Esther's watching the mother fox, who sits down on her rocky outpost and yawns widely.
Hunger may force them into taking livestock, where they risk being shot.
The cubs continue to frolic with each other. One lies on its back, gently pawing a sibling, showing the white fur on its belly.
The odds are that not all of these cubs will survive the coming winter or go on to breed. But the Arctic fox has an almost heroic ability to turn hardship into opportunity. This mum's given them the best possible start in life.
The mother stands on a rock, staring straight ahead, eyes narrowed, almost as if in contemplation. Now the peninsula, then a large deep blue lake. Ominous clouds dominate the sky above.
This far north, the limits to life for animals and humans are very stark. So Icelanders have never been shy of taking from nature. Traditionally, they've harvested everything from seabirds to whales, fish to seals, some of which they still take today.
Catching puffins in a net.
But it's clear that if you live on an island, especially one so remote and northerly, you cannot take more than you need.
A small fishing boat pulls into a harbour.
Ever since the Vikings first landed, fishing the rich offshore waters have been fundamental to the country's economy. In the 1970s, Iceland even used gunboats to defend a 200-mile fishing limit around their coast. Today, with careful management, their fisheries are some of the most sustainable in the world.
Inside a warehouse, two men are sorting the day's catch of fish.
Their long-term thinking has helped other countries too. Icelandic rivers are important spawning grounds for the Atlantic salmon.
Two salmon swimming upstream.
But in the 1980s, salmon started to decline, due mainly to overfishing by commercial operations on the high seas. By raising funds to buy out the netting operations, effectively paying them not to fish, millions of salmon were given a chance to return to rivers from Norway to North America.
A fisherman standing in the water.
The problem is far from over. Striking a balance between harvesting and protecting is an ongoing effort, but Icelanders manage it in their own unique way. It's a country where hunting and gathering sit side by side with modern life.
A time-lapse shows nightfall on an Icelandic town.
A nation with a dynamic economy built around Reykjavik, the most northerly capital city in the world. Cheap, clean, renewable power warms homes, keeps the lights on, and provides mains hot water. Even city pavements have underfloor heating. Reykjavik's Opera House celebrates music and drama inspired by the original Icelandic sagas. But Icelanders are necessarily rooted in reality. They can never forget they're living over a huge and widening tear in the Earth's crust. And And as summer draws to a close, the giant reservoir of molten rock under them is beginning to stir.
Still waters and snowy hills in the far distance.
Back on the Breidafjörde Islands, wild eider offspring are learning what to eat by watching their parents.
A duckling leaps up and dives down, and a moment later, another follows suit. Nearer the shore, an adult has its head and bill beneath the surface while a duckling observes solemnly. Thor's ducklings.
It's Thor's job to introduce his ducklings to the kind of food that will keep them going out on the open water. When they grow up, they'll be diving mainly for mollusks, which they eat, shell and all. Tiny crustaceans, stirred up from the shoreline, are good starter foods.
He pats at the edge of a puddle, encouraging them to investigate.
In the end, Thor, as a surrogate duck dad, can only give them a helping hand.
A duckling gorges on the mollusks that Thor holds out on his hand.
Little by little, they spread their wings, foraging a little further from home, becoming a little wilder every day.
But they swim then in between either here or close to the island and go their own trips to feeding, but they always come home in the evening. So they find something in this ocean to eat, so it makes them a good start in the new life in the world.
Ducklings scavenge in a puddle, seeking food.
Eventually, Thor leaves them on their own. His nurturing work is done. Nature will take over from here. But Thor hopes their homing instinct will bring them back to his islands next year.
Walking up a grassy slope, the brilliant sunset behind him silhouettes his figure against the vast sky. Now a long valley.
In the high pastures, ripening blueberries and the turning leaves mark the slide to autumn.
Two blueberries amidst orange leaves.
Even though the first snows are dusting the mountains, it's a time eagerly awaited by farmers in the northern area of Skagafjörde, for it also heralds the event of their social calendar, the annual roundup.
In the heart of a valley, next to a shallow river that snakes past, people are gathered with horses. Haldor says the roundup has always been a great celebration in Iceland, where people got together. In olden days, people found it harder to get together, but now it's easier. I can barely hold back the tears thinking about it. Sitting next to him on a sofa is son-in-law Snorri. At the roundup, almost everyone's on a horse.
The horses might die up here in winter blizzards, so farmers join forces to gather up the different herds and drive them all down the valley. For this year's foals, it's a complete surprise to be near humans again. And it goes against the grain.
Horses of all colours, tans, whites and browns, gallop across the valley. A few people on horseback guide the wild horses. A man on horseback rides his steed through shallow water, and some of the wild herd follow.
But this independent spirit is exactly what Haldor and Snorri want. It's what the Vikings saw in the ancestors of these horses when they traded them from Mongolia and brought them to Iceland over 1,000 years ago.
The wild horses continue to make their way through the valley. Now, a large gathering of people and vehicles.
This is horse trading, nature's way.
Pens encircle a corral, which has a large gate at one end that's open. Horses are already inside some of the pens. Now, the wild horses, hemmed in either side by low concrete walls, canter down into the corral. People wander in and around the beasts.
Somehow, each farmer must separate their own horses from the crowd. But they're judging everyone else's at the same time.
The horses are flighty, unnerved, and difficult to handle.
No horse is broken in until it's at least 4 years old, so most of them have a mind of their own. But this is what they love about them.
Two unruly horses.
It's been the only way to raise horses in Iceland's harsh environment.
Halldór's also in the corral.
Their return from the mountains, though, always brings deep relief.
He wanders about, looking at the horses. He says, people felt together and were delighted to meet up. It always brought joy to the farmer's heart and mind when he got his animals back. The horses, the sheep, to see them again. Only a half-dead man does not rejoice over seeing his animals again. One by one, small gates leading off the corral into the individual pens are opened and horses are shooed through them.
When all is done, Halldór and Snorri will lead the horses back to the farm, as generations have done before them.
Sitting with Snorri, Halldór says, in Icelandic we say, strong is the bond which draws the boy to the father's fields. Now, people leaving the roundup, trotting along a road on horseback, with wild horses herded along behind them. Those who live off the land must have respect for it. The reason we respect it is because we are attached to it. To us, attachment to the land and respect are one and the same thing. The vastness of an agate blue sky, snowy hills in the distance, and the riders and their wild horses traversing the terrain.
The land under their feet demands respect. And in this, of all years, high in the central plateau, the Bárðarbungur volcano has sprung into life. Over 1,000 earthquakes in a single day suggest a huge volume of molten rock trying to reach the surface. But where? Fearing massive floods, should the eruption melt the Vatnajökull glacier, search and rescue teams evacuate a vast area. Hour by hour, scientists track the earth tremors that mark the movement of the magma. The column of hot rock is snaking northwards.
The scientists look from side to side as they travel in a 4x4 across a stark, barren landscape.
Eventually, it breaks through a fissure in the plains, just beyond the edge of the glacier.
It's big, probably the biggest a lava eruption that we have seen for 30 years or so, I would guess.
As it turns out, nothing like it has been seen on Iceland for over 200 years.
Nighttime, a slow-flowing river of lava oozes forwards with many cracks in its blackened surface, revealing the hot orange glow underneath.
The fissure is about 400 metres long, but lava pours out at nearly 300 cubic meters a second, like a cut that won't stop bleeding. Underneath Iceland, the Eurasian plate is pulling eastwards, and the North American plate is pulling westwards. Until this eruption, the island has been spreading apart at 2 centimeters a year. Here, it's opening up 10 times faster. The lava is a ferocious 1,200 degrees centigrade. It would melt even cast iron and incinerate a human being in seconds. This is as close as we get to seeing into the center of the Earth.
With a consistency similar to dough, the lava spills ever onward on its inexorable path. In the distance, the night sky has turned a deep red-orange and showers of molten sparks rise up like fountains. A scientist is silhouetted against the fiery fissure.
The ground shakes as the fissure splits open even further, creating a rift that's 1.5 kilometers long.
All along the rift, showers of lava spew upwards. The scientists are near the rift, tiny silhouettes against the backdrop of the lava fountains.
Pumped by pressure that's been building for centuries, superheated gas and water causes tons of lava to fountain up to 100 meters into the air, all along its length. These are the same monumental forces that created Iceland in the first place.
Spraying upwards in waves, the liquid lava continues to gush out of the rift, splashing as it lands on the cooling, blackened crust. The colour turns a brooding dark orange as it fountains up into the air, contrasting starkly against the backdrop of the pitch-black night. Still at full fury, the fountains merge and become a fervid wall of lava. Small rivulets of cooling lava run down a small slope over the crust. Lumps of blackened crust form a barrier in front of the wall, and globules of lava rain down on them, landing thickly, spilling downwards quickly and cooling, adding to the crust. Tempestuous and unceasing, the flaming fountains are a spectacular light show. Ruby-red rivulets of the cooling lava continue to splay outwards from the rift.
Over the next 6 months, the lava flow covers over 85 square kilometers.
The lava flow rolls on.
85,000 tons of poisonous sulfur dioxide is released into the atmosphere every day.
Clouds of sulfur rise up into the atmosphere.
In 1783, an eruption on Iceland threw up so much ash and sulfur dioxide that it's thought to have caused famine on a global scale, and the deaths of 6 million people worldwide. Miraculously, this fissure allows the colossal pressure under Bowther Bunker to be released slowly. Had it gone off just a few kilometers away, explosively under the Vatnajökull glacier, the picture would be very different.
An enormous cloud of sulfur from the lava flow dominates the blue sky.
It's the ultimate reminder that the lives of all Icelanders depend on the raw forces beneath them.
Viewed from above, the vast cloud of sulfur and the fiery red lava flow.
A wildlife. Uniquely connected to nature, it may be, but the remarkable people and animals that live here have learned how to work with the land rather than fight against it. They've taken all of Iceland's opportunities and challenges in their stride.
A white Arctic fox throws its head back as it cries out.